Please help me welcome our speaker tonight. We have Steve M. from the Sponsorship Group in Chatham, New Jersey.
Hey everybody, my name is Steve. I'm an alcoholic.
Hey.
It's good to be here and it's good to be sober. My sobriety date is April 22nd, 2005, and my home group, as your leader announced, is the Sponsorship Group. We meet in Chatham, New Jersey on Sunday nights at 8:30. It's an open speaker meeting. I recently became the booker, which I'm excited about. And so I can tell you with assurance that we'll have some solid speakers coming to Jersey. I'm not too nervous speaking, but for some reason tonight I'm terrified. That's funny for you. I got 55 minutes left. A bunch of us before we left, I sat down with my sponsor and he just took one look at me and he said, "Why don't you make a list of all the things that you're not talking about, that you're not dealing with, so you can go out there and give a good talk?" And that's the kind of sponsor I have in Alcoholics Anonymous. He takes an active interest in my life. After he took me through the steps, it wasn't sort of like a pat on the butt and there you go, good luck. It was, I'm accountable to him in every area of my life. I bring the problems with women that I have, if I'm fortunate enough to have those problems. I bring my problems with money to him, if I'm fortunate enough to have those problems. I bring everything to him, and as a result, I have a relationship with him that I've invested a lot of time in, and that he's invested a lot of time in, and I've learned a lot about, how to interact with people from that relationship with my sponsor. But he saw right away that there was a lot of stuff going on behind, in my head, which is always a bad thing. And I sort of did a little inventory with him before we left, so it was good. You guys will have a much better talk, trust me. The talk I was going to give before I did that inventory was terrible, and I assure you this will be much better, I hope. I met up with a bunch of members of my home group who are here in the front row, thank you guys for all supporting and taking the ride out with me. We do that as a group. We roll as a pack. Some people like to call us a cult, whatever have you. I like to think of them as family, so I appreciate you guys coming out tonight. To start, really, I guess, I really didn't think that I was an alcoholic, okay? My idea of what an alcoholic was and what kinds of people belonged in AA meetings were one of four types of people. You were either a hobo, a biker, a pirate, or a Viking. Nice college boys like me didn't belong in the rooms of AA. I was too smart. I was too good-looking. I had way too much going for me. I really didn't want to hang out with the likes of you people in Alcoholics Anonymous. I mean, obviously I had a little bit of a pride problem, but my perception was distorted. I really didn't know what alcoholism was. I had no idea what had been killing me slowly for 25 years before I came to the rooms of AA. I didn't have the slightest clue. My idea of what alcoholism was what you would probably have seen in any, representation in the media or entertainment of what an alcoholic is, Or sometimes even in meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous, that message of, I drank and I lost everything, And I used to think to myself, that's not really me. See, I never really got to the everything point to lose it, firstly. The second thing was that it just seemed to me like people who drank, people in Alcoholics Anonymous were people who drank and lost control. And that was never my story. See, for me, what alcohol always did, and the reason that I drank was because when I drank, it was the only time that I felt like I was in control. Okay, that sober, I felt like it was chaos. Constant chaos, fear, tension, shame, guilt, remorse, you name it. All the fun emotions, the amp just turned all the way up on those things, and I never could get a handle on them until I had a couple of drinks, and then, the belly lets out, the shoulders drop. I feel like I can breathe for the first time during the course of the day. So you see, I'm not an alcoholic, because alcoholics are people who have drinking problems. I don't have a drinking problem. Drinking is my solution. I have a sober problem. But who do you tell that to? I mean, before I came to AA, the people who knew me just thought I was nuts. I mean, they didn't know what to do with me. And I'm grateful today that I'm an alcoholic, because it explains a lot of things about me that I don't know what I would have had to do to fix all the other problems if it was more complicated than that. One of the things that struck me when I first came to Alcoholics Anonymous, I went to this meeting. It was my second meeting. It was a big book meeting, which, you know, it may as well have been in Chinese. You know what I mean? People reading out of the big book when you're brand new, it didn't make any sense. And it was from the chapter to employers, you know, which scared me. You know what I mean? To be honest, it was like, I got to work now? Come on. You know what I mean? Like, this is hard enough as it is, and now we're going to talk about employers already? Jesus. I was like, did my parents put you up to this? But I got a copy of my big book, and they wanted to collect at the end of the meeting, and I was going to put the book back in the basket, but I noticed that the leader of the meeting was a woman, so, you know, I thought I should wait and hand it to her personally. I wanted to make the approach, and I went up to her after the meeting and sort of was like, I forgot to hand this in, you know, and she looked at me and was like, why don't you hold on to it? You look like you need it more than we do. Now I know, you know, I had newcomer written all over my face. Then I didn't realize, I just thought she, you know, wanted to be nice to me because she wanted to sleep with me. And which didn't happen, but I did get a copy of the big book. Not quite the consolation prize I was looking for, but I went home and I read it, and I remember reading the doctor's opinion first, and I had always prided myself on my intellect. I think a lot of us here do. You know, our ability to figure things out. Even though they never work out, that didn't stop me from trying to figure them out, you know? And I was going to, you know, get an A+ in AA, so I started studying up. I wanted to figure out all the angles and really read up. But I'll tell you, I was blown away by what I read in the doctor's opinion, you know? I'm not a big book thumper, but I'll tell you, the big book hit me, you know what I mean? It really hit me because I had spent the majority of my life up to that point, up to that night, up to doing that reading, feeling terribly alone and feeling like nobody understood me, you know. And when people would ask me, what's your problem? What were you thinking? Why did you do that? I would just say, I don't know. Like, I can't explain why I act the way that I act. I can't explain why I hurt people the way I do or why I do the things I do. I don't have any more clue than you do. And I remember reading that line about the allergy, and it just shut me down. You know, that the truth has always had that effect on me. It shuts me down. You know, that's how I know, because it hits me so hard I can't fight anymore. And, you know, this idea that when I drank it produced a symptom of craving that was beyond my physical and mental control made sense to me, because all of my experiences, I stopped and I remember thinking back to all the times that I drank and all the times that I tried to promise myself that I wasn't going to drink more than X number of drinks. But every time I drank, I lost control. Now, I want to clarify losing control, because like I said, I didn't identify with that, like, you know, drink and then go down in a hail of gunfire, you know. I didn't identify with the drink and getting in car wrecks or getting arrested. I wasn't one of those people who joked and said, you know, I'm allergic to alcohol. When I drink, I break out in handcuffs. You know, my story was like, I would drink and you'd find me under a piece of furniture somewhere bawling hysterically. I was a real party guy. But I remember reading that line and thinking about every night my drive up to the bar. I lived in a town called Florham Park, New Jersey, and all the bars nearby were in this town called Morristown. If anybody's ever been to New Jersey, Morristown's got some good bars. They got some seedy bars, they got some clubby bars, they got some preppy bars, they got everything. And I would drive up there on a weeknight, and on the way up there I'd have the same conversation with myself. I'd say, Steve, tonight you're just going to have two. Okay, last night, you drove home in a blackout. You know, you could have killed yourself. You could have killed somebody else. You know, you called your ex-girlfriend crying at 4:30 in the morning. You, cursed out your parents. You know, I would go through the list of damage that I had done. And hoping that by recalling all of that misery and pain that I would somehow be able to exhibit more control tonight. And okay, two drinks. And I would get to the bar, and I would confidently order the first drink, thinking that I'm going to be a normal drinker tonight, you know? And I'd have the first drink, and then I'd get halfway through the second drink, and this switch would flip. And a different voice would pop into my head. And it would be like, Steve, we were much too hard on ourselves in the car ride over here. You are a really nice guy. You know, deep down, you're a good guy, you know? You deserve another drink. It's Tuesday, you know? And then I would order the third, because I would say, well, you know I said two, but I've changed my mind now. I'm going to have three. And I would have the third, and then, you know, Andy would walk in, and I spent a majority of my time at that point in my life with Andy. So the last time I saw him was probably no more than 6 hours ago. But you know how it is with us. You know, Andy walked in, and I was like, Andy! You know? And now we got to order a round of shots, and, you know, so to celebrate his arrival and us seeing each other again. And, you know, and the whole time that I was drinking, I mean, I promise you, every time I drank, I thought I made the decision to pick up that drink. I really believed with all my heart that I was making that choice. And I had no idea that once I put it in my body, I was no longer making any choices about how much I was going to have. Because I have a physical abnormal reaction to alcohol. You know, you hear abnormal and you think bad, but we all know it's damn good. You know? I mean, we wouldn't have been here or done the things that we did for as long as we did if it wasn't for the good things, you know. But alcohol did such a good job at making me a man that it almost ensured that I would never become one without it. Further along in the doctor's opinion, another thing that really grabbed me was this line, the alcoholic without a drink is restless, irritable, and discontented until he can experience a sense of ease and comfort he gets from just a few drinks. Drinks that he sees others taking with impunity. And, like I said, I feel like I'm lecturing, but this is just how it hit me. And I remember reading that line and just thinking, like, oh my God, I'm just an alcoholic. And, like, I wanted to cry because I had a laundry list of things that I thought were wrong with me before I read that line. I really did. I mean, I had been to therapists, I had been to counselors, I had been to, psychiatrists, I had been to priests, family, friends. I mean, I had gone to everybody just, like, with that, like, feeling like, what's wrong with me? Just tell me, you know? And they'd be like, well, you know, you're clinically depressed, you have social anxiety disorder, and you're obsessive compulsive. Take these, you know? And I was like, but I just felt like it was really the first time that somebody was describing my problem and at the same time giving me a solution that sit right in my heart. I just knew. I knew I was in the right place when that all hit me all at once. I thought, you know what, Steve? If you really look back at your drinking, truth be told, after a couple of drinks, you didn't have any problems. So maybe it's the alcohol. You know, maybe you're just alcoholic. And all the fighting that I had, all the thoughts of I was over-mothered, I was under-fathered, you know, it's the job, it's the lack of the job, it's the woman, it's the lack of the woman, all that other stuff, man, just slipped away, and I realized that the only problem I ever had was that I was alcoholic, you know, and that most of the problems I had were when I was sober, you know, that I suffered from a serious booze deficiency, you know. I kind of say that to start out because, I mean, that was the stuff that really got me here. That was the hook. You know, the next thing that grabbed me was listening to speakers talk from the podium about wanting to die sober, because that's how I felt. I wanted to die, and I was sober. And it wasn't because of the tragic and terrible things I did while drinking. A lot of it was because all the things that I didn't do but should have done sober, you know. And I don't know, you know, you guys just pulled me in. I don't know what it was. I mean, there was there was a lot of fear, and there was a lot of judgment, you know. I mean, I just looked around and thought, like, oh, shit. You know? I mean, like, this is going to suck, you know? I mean, like, I remember thinking, actually, going to bed one night, thinking, like, man, if you had only just tried to control your drinking a little bit better, you wouldn't have burned it out so fast and be stuck with these losers, you know? Now you're just going to have to rot in the basements of churches all over the state of New Jersey with the rest of them. But like I said, I mean, today I'm just, I couldn't be more grateful for Alcoholics Anonymous or what it's given me. But, I didn't know any of this before AA, and, you know, just to give you a little bit of, you know, background information, I mean, I grew up in a home where there was a lot of love. You know, the older I get and the longer I stay sober, the more inventories I do, the better my childhood gets. Because when I came in here, I would have told you that my dad was a jerk and he was never around for me, never showed up. He didn't care. All he cared about was making money. And my mom was an overbearing psychopath, you know. Which... No, I love her. She's great. She's awesome. But I mean, I remember as a kid, I remember my mom, you know, even from when I was like a baby, I remember, you know, being held and being sang to and being, you know, being told how wonderful I was and how much they loved me. And I remember my father, even though he worked long hours, I remember being in bed and waking up and having him sit on the end of my bed and having him be all excited because he got a promotion and the things that he was going to be able to do for the family with the money that he got from his promotion. And he would be waking me up to tell me these things and share with me. And it's, you know, where we do things like, I heard, you know, you didn't do so well in that spelling test. You know, why don't we go over it right now? What was the word that tripped you up? You know, and I mean, I came from a lot of love. I really did. I can't point to anything in my past, in my childhood, other than me as being problematic. There was some discord in my family, which I think is normal for any families. You know, I think my father belongs in these rooms, but that's just my opinion. That's not my, you know, I can't really make any decisions or say anything about that. But, you know, he drank a lot, and sometimes he would yell and scream, and I would get scared, and sometimes him and my mom would fight, and he would leave, and, you know, there was both good and bad, but nothing out of the ordinary, you know? And, I went to school and just remember feeling so much less than everybody around me. You know, like I said, I had all that love. You would think that I would go into school feeling like $1 million, but I would go into school, man, and I would take one look around and go, uh-oh, you know? Like, I don't have what it takes. You know, I know that I was born with this alcoholism thing, this spiritual malady that they talk about in the Big Book, because there has been something broken inside of me that, you know, has been going on since as far back as I can remember. And it definitely wasn't coming from the outside in. It was always coming from the inside out. You know, everybody's telling me that they love me, that I'm special, that I've got nothing but all the potential to do great things. And the message that I'm hearing in my head is, you're a piece of crap, you're going to screw this up, don't even try, why bother, you're a screw up, just leave it alone, don't make eye contact, just walk away. You know, where did that come from? Because it wasn't coming from out there, you know, it was coming from in here. And I really believe that's where my alcoholism lives, is right, you know. But I went through school and I tried to be like the other kids as best as I could, you know. You try to play along. I always felt sort of like Pinocchio, though, you know, like hoping one day I'd wake up and be a real boy. I tried to play sports, but I was a mixture of really unathletic and massively self-centered, which is a terrible mixture for any team sport at all, you know. It makes gameplay tough. Little League, and I always share this because I'm hoping that somewhere in the audience there's some guy that just had a terrible childhood because he sucked at Little League too, and you can laugh with me at this, but the only time I got on base was because I got hit in the face with a pitch. That was my moment to shine, you know. I was at first base in the game, you know. Like, thanks everybody. I, you know, didn't do anything for it, but this was all, again, this is all from the encouragement of parents who knew that to live a good life, you get involved in things. You know, you get involved and you give something your all. I missed the give something your all part of that message, by the way. Because I would go to Little League and I would go to soccer and I would go to basketball. And I would go to like 2 or 3 practices a week while all the other kids were going to 7. And I wanted to be the star player. You know what I mean? And I would hate my coach for not putting me in the game. Meanwhile, during practice, like, I was like staring at my feet. You know what I mean? I wasn't involved. But I was always like, you know, they're screwing me. But the truth was that I wasn't giving it my all. And they knew that, and they saw that. Why would they put me in? And, you know, I thought I should be first string. I was the kid getting hit in the face with the pitches. I wasn't first string material. But not because I was unathletic or because I was a bad kid. It was because I was selfish. You know, when I did an inventory, man, I could see that selfishness shot through every area of my life. You know, and really, like the book talks about fear as being that evil and corroding thread. My self-centeredness played that same role in everything that I did. So I just grew up feeling uncomfortable, and you know, the first time I had a drink, it was right after I made the move from public school to private school, and I got sent to one of these private schools that was known for its ability to prepare kids for college, you know, and it was filled with a lot of the best from New Jersey, and I tell you this, I don't know what the hell I was doing there. I talked to the headmaster before I went, and I remember him saying, like, you know, you barely passed the placement exam for here, you know, but I know your family and I think the school's going to do you kind of good, so I'm going to let you in. And I got in there, man, and I felt insignificant and like I didn't measure up when I was in public school. And now in this environment, I was sure I was a freak, you know, because I looked around, man, and these kids were, not only were they good at sports, they were good at multiple sports, you know. They were not just soccer stars, they were baseball stars, soccer stars, lacrosse stars, I mean, you know, all in one. And they had been taking Latin since the 7th grade to improve the verbal scores on their PSATs. I mean, all this stuff to me, I was just like, talking to somebody, having them tell me this for 5 minutes, I would have like anxiety attacks. You know what I mean? Like, what are they talking about? You know, like, what is this? I realize now that these people, you know, what scared me about them was that they had goals. I mean, people like that scare the crap out of me. You know, people who have purpose, direction, and have goals and aren't afraid to like go after them, I'm intimidated by them. Because there's that voice inside of me that's going like, not you, buddy. You know what I mean? You don't even bother with those things because you're gonna let yourself and everybody around you down if you try and have a goal and shoot for it, you know. And so, I don't know. But at this time now I'm playing football, which with that self-centeredness and that lack of ability to pay attention really gets you in a lot of trouble in football. I got knocked on my can a lot. I spent a lot of time looking at the sky. I was always like the last to finish in sprints. I mean, it was humiliating. You know, it was one of those. I was the guy who's, you know, the coach was like screaming my name at every practice, like, McCauley, what the hell's wrong with you? You know, and I do my, you know, like, I don't know, you know, it's like, and I was overweight and I was short. Again, just, you know, cursed from the get. And I would go into the locker room, and I remember watching everybody else around me just get so fired up for the big game. And I remember feeling heartbroken because I just could not understand what they were so excited about. They would just be like, big game on Saturday, and they're slamming their helmets into the locker, and they're smashing shoulder pads, and they are so freaking excited about life, and I'm sitting there feeling like, what the hell did I miss? What's wrong with me? What the hell is wrong with me? Why are all these people so effing excited? What did I miss? I was on the field out there. I don't feel like this. I'm not excited about life. I'm terrified. I don't know how to play. I don't know what to do. I'm less than all you people. I can't measure up. I'm never going to make it. And I, you know, at 14 years old, I was already ready to put a bullet in my brain. You know, but thank God I found alcohol. You know, I heard, I think Johnny Harris was one of the first people I heard say this, but he said that alcohol kept him alive long enough to get him safe to the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, because he said if it wasn't for alcohol, he would have put a bullet in his brain a long time ago. And that's me, man. At 14 years old, if I had a gun, I would have used it. You know, my parents went out one night and I decided to have some scotch like I had seen my dad do. You know, a good drink to start off on, scotch on the rocks. Out of a tumbler, I already was a bit precocious and stuck up and snobby. I'll have some scotch, you know. It's befitting of a man of my intellect at 14 years old. Have some scotch and watch the X-Files. Maybe they'll tell me when I'm coming home, you know? All joking aside, man, when those two scotches hit me, I just remember feeling like, oh my God, this is awesome. You know, like, where has this been all my life? And I didn't know it then, but I can describe it now. Two drinks made me feel normal. I've never drank to... I mean, I tried to. I tried to drink to party. That never worked out. But I never drank for anything other than that effect. And if I could put words on my experience with that effect, the effect was that it made me normal. It made me like you people. All you scary people out there who I couldn't talk to and who I couldn't measure up to, I had a couple of drinks and all of a sudden I wasn't such a damn freak anymore. And I can look you in the eyes and I wasn't afraid. I mean, there weren't any people around, but I felt that way. I could have gone out. I was about to. I just remember having those scotches and leaning back in my dad's lazy boy and just going, you know, like, this is awesome. You know, I can't believe I've been so stupid my whole life. I mean, these guys in that school, they're jerks. They're all jerks, you know? And the guys that are good at sports, I mean, all those guys on the football team, they're all going to become nothing. They're not going to become anything. They're not going anywhere. They're losers, you know what I mean? I'm brilliant, you know? And as I drank, it was, you know, I got bigger and bigger, and they got smaller and smaller, as one of my favorite speakers says. And it's just, I just felt so okay, you know? I couldn't drink a lot at that point in my life. I couldn't get a hold of it very often. When I did, it was always embarrassing. You know, I'll try to tell the story short, but I went to this one party, and half an hour into the party, I'm already puking. The other kids, they had a few drinks. They put their beers down, which I don't understand that. You know, you got to hold on to it because you never know when you're going to need it. And they're putting their drinks down. They're going to play volleyball because they got a little buzz on, and they're all rosy cheeked and all excited and cheery. And I just, you know, I missed that part. I got that way in about 5 minutes. I was at that point and then went right past it, right into puking. You know what I mean? I overshot the mark by a mile. And I just remember seeing them playing the volleyball as I was going to the bushes to puke. And the next thing I know, I'm in one of those like small bathrooms where the door barely clears the bowl. But if you're on the floor in one of those bathrooms and people are trying to get in, that can become sort of a problem because, you know, every 3 seconds somebody's opening the door and hitting you in the back with it. You know, and you're coming to trying to explain yourself, like, yeah, what do you say? I'm cleaning the grout. I'm busy. So I come to a little while later and I'm on the front lawn. Now, I remember seeing the girl that I was seeing at this moment, this far away. I remember seeing her when I first got to the party and just was like, you know, like, please don't let me, you know. Not her. Anybody, just not her. And her was right on top of me and was coming in for a kiss. And I was scared, but excited too, because, you know, I don't have that kind of luck usually. And I remember hearing, and I will never forget this, his name was Rob, my friend Rob Walls, who I don't know where he is now, but he was standing on the other end of that front lawn that night, and I remember him screaming, hearing him scream at her, "Leave him alone, he doesn't know what he's doing!" Now, as bad as I remember her looking, she must have been pretty bad, because they were getting, I mean, like, they were going after, like, Frankenstein, you know what I mean? Like, pitchforks and torches. And but I waved them off, because I had it under control. You know, and I knew a guy like me couldn't be picky. And but I came to a little while later, and you know, I was missing a shoe and I was covered in cupcake icing. Everybody always loves that. That's like the small. I'm still picturing this. You know, the icing was nothing. You know, that was my social drinking. And I learned after that experience that guys like me can't drink in public. You know, that was what that experience taught me. It didn't teach me, "Steve, you have a drinking problem." What it showed me was that, "Steve, you shouldn't drink around other people." You know, and at like 15, 16 years old, I already had the habits of like a closet alcoholic. I had 2 big bottles of rum that I stole from and I wanted to sound more badass than I am. I didn't steal it, but they gave it to me, whatever, stole, gave. And I put it under my, they gave me these 2 handles of rum, and they said they didn't want them, I don't know why. And I hid them under my bed and would come home as like a sophomore in high school and acted like I had seen my dad act after coming home working a 12-hour day on Wall Street. And I had just spent 6 hours in high school, but I put on the same sort of like, you know, come in like, you know, like, geometry was crazy. Drop the bag and like go in my room and slam the door and draw the blinds and pull out the bottle, and I would have cocktail hour at like 3:30 in the afternoon and call my friends and play on AOL, you know. tough guy things, you know. And and I never really thought there was anything wrong with it. I mean, I knew what I was doing was wrong as far as, like, you know, I couldn't tell anybody about it, but I didn't think that, you know, at 16 I wasn't stopping going, maybe I'm an alcoholic, there's something weird about my drinking. But as soon as I started drinking, like, I already knew I needed it. Like, I couldn't get the day off me without it. I couldn't unleash or unravel that knot in my stomach without it. And, you know, I would do things like I would sneak drinks before I went out to hang out with my friends when they weren't drinking. You know, like, oh, we're going to a concert, my mom will be there in like 15 minutes to pick you up. And I'd be like, okay, and I'd hang up and like wait, figure out where my parents were in the house, make it, you know, quick line to the liquor cabinet, you know, and slam as much as I could of whatever bottle I knew that they weren't drinking from, because, you know, you don't want to drink what they drink, because then they'll notice if you drink too much, you know what I mean? You follow? And, you know, and then I just put it down as much as I could and then go out with my friends, and they'll be like, what's wrong with you? And I'd be like, nothing. You know, but I needed it. I needed it to be around you people, because I was so terrified and just disconnected. I needed that booze. And I'll tell you, at 17 years old, I stopped drinking. And it wasn't because of any other reason other than I was sick of embarrassing myself. Because that I tried to drink socially some more, and it went a lot like that night I had just described. I don't need to get into more detail with that. You know, a lot of just puking on myself, passing out, parents being called early, being picked up on the side of the road. You know, just really embarrassing stuff. And I started to become the guy that, like, everybody was just like, what's wrong with him? And so I stopped because I was embarrassed and people were noticing. And I really believe what they say about this illness, it's progressive, because it hadn't progressed enough that I couldn't get through it with, you know, I didn't have a sponsor, I didn't go to AA, I didn't even think I was alcoholic. I just said, I'm going to stop drinking now. And I'll tell you, I really believe that it was at that point in my life that the seed was planted that a guy like me needs God. And it's just that simple. You know, I'm not going to overcomplicate it, but that's really just, there was a lesson that I learned. I had an experience at that point in my life that taught me that somebody like me cannot get by alone, that I need to believe in something. Otherwise, I won't make it. And what ended up happening was, at this point, I stopped drinking. I'm going crazy. I feel detached. I'm alone. I'm depressed. I'm psychotic. I have to go on this retreat with my church, which did not seem like a good idea. Trust me. I wasn't all excited about it then, but I went because I had to, because I was getting confirmed in the church. And in my family, that's just what you do. And part of confirmation class involved this weekend-long retreat. And something happened over that weekend. And I really believe, looking back, you know, where they talk about, you know, you hear the speakers talk about, they talk about in the Bible somewhere, a mustard seed, that you just got to open your mind just a little bit just to let God in. And I think that's what happened over the weekend. Something cracked me open and God got in there. Because at the end of the weekend, they had these things that, it was a lot like, you know, an AA meeting. Everybody from the weekend got up and shared from a podium about the experiences that they had over the course of the weekend and like how God, how they changed or how something affected them. And after like the 10th or 15th person, you know, something started to just, that wall dropped, and I started to, you know, I was like, oh my God, like everybody felt something here. Something happened here. And I believed. I started to believe in something. And I started to have hope, and I started to have goals, you know, God forbid. And literally. And I, you know, just, you know, I started to think about my future and wanted to become a teacher, and I was going to go off to college and double major, and I was going to do English and philosophy, and I'm going to be a professor, and I had all these hopes. And I got really involved in the church, and I didn't realize what I was doing then until much later, until I came into the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, that at that point in my life, I was treating my alcoholism before I even knew I had it. You know, I had all the important elements there, except I wasn't sharing with another alcoholic, which I think is the most important element of this fellowship. You know, one alcoholic sharing with another alcoholic for the purpose of recovery. That was the one thing that was missing. But the other things that I did have that got me by for a couple of years was God. It was God and a lot of actions. It was a lot of prayer, a lot of faith in action, a lot of trying to help others, going on more of these retreats, sharing with people about God, talking about God. And my life started to get good, and it got a little brighter, and I wasn't that depressed, reclusive little teenager anymore. I started to become a real person, you know. And then I went off to college, and something changed. I started to get the feeling like everybody was screwing me. And I'll tell you, my alcoholic thinking today is no different than it was then. You know, when people drink or when people leave AA, and I've never had this experience, but I know what it's like to get close to that. You know, my alcoholic thinking is what comes back first. What comes back first is the everybody's out to get me. They're all screwing me. I'm not getting what I deserve. You know, I'm sick of being pushed around. You know, I got to just do what I want. Screw everybody else. And that hit me kind of hard in college because it was, I went to school in New York City, and it wasn't really cool to talk about Jesus there. You know, the only people talking about God or Jesus in New York City are standing on boxes on corners, you know what I mean? So, you know, I didn't want to be grouped in with those people, and, you know, I just started to do what I thought, just going to have some fun, you know what I mean? Just going to have some fun. And what started off as like a Thursday night tradition with a bunch of buddies where we would go and get 40s from the local deli that didn't card, and sit in my room and drink and have play video games turned into, by the time I graduated college, I was an every night bar drunk. Fast forward 3 years, the girl that I was dating at the time, who was like my high school sweetheart, who I was going to marry, I left her because she got in the way of my drinking, because she started to say things like, why do you hang out with those people? You know, did you ever think maybe you drink too much? And it was, as soon as she started saying stuff like that, it was just like, you know what, you got to go. And I don't remember making that conscious decision, but I just started to back off. Because she was getting in the way of me doing what I needed to do, you know. And my drinking ramped up over the next 3 years. I went through a lot of just, you know, my junior year in college was like a bunch of blackouts strung together by some mere sobriety in between. And, you know, I don't know. I didn't do a lot of horrible things. I mean, I think I acted out in a lot of selfish ways, especially, you know, with women and stuff like that. But I just remember, as soon as I started drinking again, as soon as it ramped up, that old feeling of hopelessness just came right back. That feeling of disconnectedness, that feeling like there's nothing to look forward to. And at the time, I was studying philosophy, which is really, really bad for an alcoholic. You know what I mean? It really is the worst. It is. It's like pouring gas on a fire. It's just terrible. And I started quoting obscure German philosophers, and, you know, just nothing means anything anymore anyway, you know, screw you. That's how I sounded in my head. On the outside, I was really like, oh, okay, you know, but I just started to fall apart all over again, and graduated college thinking, you know, if I get the job, there was always this part of me that always said, when I do this next thing, then I won't have to drink this way anymore. I won't be this person. And for me, it was always that thing that I grew up with, the American dream. If I get that career and I get that job and the car and the house and the wife and the kids, I won't have to drink this way anymore. I couldn't get those things going. I tried, but I don't know. I really, what ended up happening for me was that I went off to law school as a sort of last-ditch attempt to get my life together, thinking that a couple letters after my name would fix me. And I decided to go to school in Milwaukee because it was a good 1,000 miles away from everybody around here, from all the people that cared about me so much, but in the middle of my alcoholism, those people that care about me are inconvenient, and they're all jerks, and they're all buttoned into my business, and why don't they leave me alone? You know, it's so, what scares me the most about my alcoholism is that it, Clancy talks about it as this disease of perception. I mean, that's what really scares me about the illness that I have, because people who love me and care about me, if I'm not taking the right kind of action, I wake up one morning and they're all out to get me. You know, and I will run and take actions based on those delusional thoughts and destroy my life and the lives of the people around me, all because of my alcoholism. Because I believe the delusional thinking that goes on up here. It scares the crap out of me, because it's happened to me in recovery, and it's always a risk, you know, it's not going to go away. But there's a solution, you know. At that time, I just tried to go to law school, didn't work out. I made it through a semester. It's just like constant panic attacks in between drinks. I would try to stay sober longer so I could be present for class, and I was just losing my mind. And eventually what happened was I just left and came home. My uncle, who was sort of the family alcoholic, the one that everybody pointed to and said, you know, he's the real alcoholic because he lost his job because of his drinking, so you see, he's the alcoholic, and we're not the alcoholics, or I'm not the alcoholic. He died. He was 55 years old. He had bounced in and out of every rehab in New Jersey. He even went to Alina Lodge, which is supposed to be the, you know, creme de la creme of rehabs. And I got the call on January 2nd, which is his birthday. They found him dead in his car in the driver's seat because he bled out from a massive head wound. And they don't know how it happened. They don't know if he got in a drunken fight or fell down a flight of steps. They never investigated any further. And I remember at that point in my life, something smacking me like right upside the head and going, that's where you're headed, buddy. That is where you are headed if you do not do something different. And I went back to school and tried to hold it together, and I ended up coming back to New Jersey and just, you know, went the therapy route at first, which didn't work because I was lying. really ineffective way to go to therapy. On the way to the therapist's office, I remember driving there and just making up stories in my head of what I was going to tell him so I could get the right response from him. So, you know, and he kind of nailed me. He got me on this thing that I said when I first started working with him. He said, okay, when we start working, I don't want you to drink anymore. And what I heard was, don't get drunk, right? Because I remember saying to him, I said, he goes, I thought you said you weren't going to drink when we started this thing. I said, no, I would never say that. And he was like, he looked at me funny, and I was like, I don't like that look, you know? I know what's going on here. And you know that feeling like when you're the end of your, like when you're finally done drinking and you start feeling like you're getting painted into a corner? I said, no, I would have never agreed to that. And he said, well, let's just say you were an alcoholic. And I was like, okay, is this theory? You know? He's like, yeah, let's just say you're alcoholic. What would be wrong if you were an alcoholic? I said, well, I know what happens to alcoholics, Doc. You know? They can't drink. And he just looked at me and he was like, here's the number for intergroup. But I called and I went to this meeting, and I knock therapy a lot. I don't know why. I've been to different therapeutic type things before, but he was actually pretty good. He told me to call him on the way to the meeting. You know, he really, his heart was in the right place. Not that he could do anything really to help me except push me to AA, but he did. He got me into the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I just started going to meetings by myself and just sat there just thinking, like, what the hell did I do to deserve this? You know, like, oh my God. And, you know, I think that my first experience was a real sort of first step in that feeling of powerlessness. I went to this meeting, and it was a discussion meeting, and I decided to share at the beginning of the meeting, which if you're new and you go to a discussion meeting, I'm just going to advise you just wait till the end, because I shared first, which gave everybody ample time to tell me what they thought. I was like, Steve, alcoholic, and they're like, hey, Steve, and I'm like, yeah. I've been sober for 3 days. I was sober a little while in high school. I think I got the sobriety thing down. My friends are going to be hanging out, drinking, watching the Yankees game. I'm not going to drink. I'm just going to go hang out with them, drink some coffee, drink some ginger ale, whatever. I think I'm all right. Thanks. You know, like, I was picturing, like, every hand in the room went up, you know what I mean? And I was like, uh-oh, you know, like, what to do? And, you know, it was like one after the other in my experience, and I'm like, oh, you know, like, this is terrible. And what pushed me over the edge was this one woman who was sitting in the back corner, because it was a small room, and there were two rows of chairs in a circle. So there was, like, the back row that was hidden, and she was tucked back there. And she shared, and she sounded sort of like, I mean, she looked like the Crypt Keeper. And I just remember looking at her thinking, like, you got to be kidding me. This woman's going to start talking to me now, you know? Like, who the F is she? And she just stuck her little finger at me from across the room and was like, if we can't do it, you can't do it. And I was like, you know what I mean? I was like, I'm out. That's it. You know what I mean? If I got to come around to be told what to do by people like her, I'm not playing. I'm out of here. So I politely stayed for the end of the meeting, did the whole Our Father through my gritted teeth, you know, like the... You know, like, and I bolted out the door, got in the car, and I want to tell you something. After having to drop out of law school, just tearing up my parents with disappointment and everybody around me, I wanted nothing more than to stop drinking at that point in my life. I couldn't do it, but I wanted nothing more than to stop drinking. And I went to turn the key in the car, and that voice went off in my head, and it was the first time that I actually heard it. That I heard it, and it was separate from me, and it said, you know, Steve, it is Friday. You only have 3 days. You could start this whole sobriety thing over again on Monday. And I was like, I'm so fucked. I mean, that was, you know, pardon my French, but that was really how I felt, because I knew I was screwed, because I wanted nothing more than to get over this and to get to the other side of it. But it was felt like there was something, I felt like I had my own worst enemy living right inside of me. That this thing that I had didn't care whether I drank or stayed sober, didn't care whether I lived or died, it just had a goal, it just wanted a drink. And that if I didn't drink, it was going to get real upset. You know? And so I went back in the meeting after sort of sobbing there in my vehicle like a man, you know, and got the number of some people and found out where an early morning meeting was and didn't go and hung out with my friends that night, you know? Even the worst meetings, I think, work, you know? Because it helped me that night. I made it the next morning, sleeping very little. People started coming up to me and they pointed me in the direction of what was to become my home group. And I got to this meeting. I don't remember anything about it, but at the end, this guy came and found me. He said, I've seen you around. He goes, there's that guy that I was telling you about that I want you to meet. You should ask him to sponsor you. So I went up to him, just awkward, you know, the kind of like, I felt like I was asking a girl out on a date. I was like back in eighth grade again. You know, I was like, can you, would you sponsor me? You know? And he's like, yeah, I'll sponsor you. Come on. And I was like, oh, shit. Way too much enthusiasm, buddy. You know what I mean? Like, I'm a philosopher, not cool. You know what I mean? You just play it cool, tone it down. But I was, you know what, to be honest with you, I mean, at that point in my life, I was so shot out. I had, like, no judgment left. I mean, I was thinking a lot of stuff, but I was just like, whatever, you know, okay. And he took me outside, and he started taking me to the steps right outside the meeting. And just the first 2 steps, he just asked me a lot of questions, you know, a couple questions, very simple ones. You know, he asked me if my life was unmanageable, and I confidently answered no. You know? And he was like, really? And I was like, yeah, no, it's fine. I've never been arrested or anything like that. I'm cool. He said, didn't you tell me that you wanted to kill yourself? And I was like, yeah. So, you know, he's like, well, don't you think that maybe that means that your life is unmanageable? And I was like, okay, I get it. You know, like something sort of clicked. I was like, if the best ideas that I have get me to a point where I want to kill myself, if that's the best solution for living that I got, I'm not doing too hot. You know, I'm not doing so good at this life stuff. And he made it very simple. He just said that he wanted me to call him every day, and that until he got me through the steps, he wanted me to go to a meeting with him every day and learn how to do Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, he made it, this relationship very clear. He said, I'm not your buddy, I'm not your pal, I'm your sponsor. Okay? He said, I'm going to, you know, it's basically like he was going to be my mentor. You know, I picked up on it kind of quick because he was not very kind. He wasn't very talkative either, which was really pissing me off. Because I like to talk, you know what I mean? I want to sort of explain myself, and he would just like look at me, just like, shut up, you're making it too complicated, just do what I said to do. And I'm like, I went to college, jerk off, you know what I mean? Like, I got some good things up here. You know, and he was just like, nope. Like, you still want to kill yourself? And I was like, ah, you know, you got me. And I took these actions, and I, you know, I'm trying to speed this up because I want to talk a little bit about, you know, my experience over the last 4.5 years. And he pushed me right into helping others. You know, I did my 4-step and my 5th step with him. You know, he took me on that long drive for the 5th step. I got in the car, and I'll never forget. He just looked at me and he said, okay, we're on a life and death errand. Start reading. And then just started driving. And I was just like, I'm this man, I'm such a billionaire. You know, and just, and, you know, told him about all the dirty, shameful things I'd done. You know, what was surprising was the things that I held on the most to were the little things. You know what I mean? It was the little things that I did that before I even drank that really ate me up. You know, it was the sexually experimenting when I was a kid. It was, you know, not throwing a punch in that fight. And everybody saw me get my ass kicked. You know, it was the little namby-pamby stuff that really got to me. You know, but I remember sharing that stuff with him and him just going, so what? And I was like, oh, you know, I was so relieved. I remember telling him about the things that I felt the most shameful about. And he said, well, Steve, that was 14 years ago. Don't you think it's a little selfish to still be thinking about those things now? Don't you think you could find a more constructive use of your time? And I was like, that's brilliant. You know what I mean? I didn't know I could not think about myself. You know what I mean? It was like I was given permission to just stop thinking about yourself, move the F on, and go help somebody. And I was like, oh, all right, cool. You know, and I thought, and he shared some of the things that he did, and I didn't feel so alone anymore. I didn't feel like so much of a freak, you know? And I stuck close to my home group, as I do today. And they would take me on these long, long car rides to, like, to places like this. And they would start sharing stuff when I was new that I was like embarrassed for them. You know what I mean? Be like, yeah, there's one time, me and this girl, and they're like, you know, that's terrible. You know what I mean? And but by the time they were done sharing all their stuff, I was like, well, you know, I, you know, looked at my grandma's dress when she was sleeping one time. And they're all like, ah! And I was like, you know, like, okay. Like, I get all, you know, just like that mixture of like fear, but I could tell that, like, you know, like all they wanted me to do was to get honest. Like, they had like the opposite of standards, you know what I mean? I don't know what the reverse of it was, but like the more effed up I got and the more honest I was about how screwed up I felt and how much of a freak I'd been, the happier they got. And I was just like, I'm like, yeah, funny for you, jerk, you know? And they're like, oh no, let me tell you what I did. And then they would tell me something and I'd go, oh wow, yeah, no, you got me beat, you know? You know, and I, you know, and I mean, and that's the humorous side of me. I mean, the one thing that I think really floored me was this one guy in Alcoholics Anonymous one time, you know, he asked me to come over because I wasn't working, big surprise. And he said, why don't you come over, we'll hang out and talk a little bit. And he had a lot of years sober, a lot of experience at Alcoholics Anonymous, and he sat down and he told me about all the things that happened to him as a kid. And there were things that I had absolutely no experience with. They were, you know, terrible things. And he shared them with me like he had no problem with them. And I remember looking at him thinking, like, if he can be okay with himself, with those things happening to him, I got nothing to worry about. You know? And it was that kind of honesty that saved my life. You know, somebody in Alcoholics Anonymous had the, I don't know what to call it, had the faith, you know, had the had this program to the point where they knew that if they would let their armor down, that would save me. And he did. And that blew me away. And it kept me coming. And, you know, over the next couple of years, I was pushed into sponsoring people. I started sponsoring people at like 35 days. I got a homeless guy in New York. If you're new and you want to sponsor people, go towards the homeless. They're very willing to get in the car because they don't have a lot of plans. And and I don't do that. I'm not making fun of you. I mean, it's just the way it is. You know, I mean, you go and it's like, what do you got planned? You know, what are you doing? And they're like, nothing. And like, do you want to get something to eat? You know, and I was taught that by somebody. You know, and Alcoholics Anonymous, that same guy who opened up to me, he said, this is how you 12-step somebody. You say, would you like something to eat? Can I buy you something to eat? And they say, yeah, sure, I'd like that. And then you take them to get something to eat and you tell them your story. And I was like, okay. You know, and I did those things. And it was like, give him some money. Tell him to be serious to call you in the morning. And this guy called. And my first sponsee, I remember getting the call that morning. I was like 35, 36 days sober. And I get a call. And this guy's like, okay, man, I thought about what you said. I want your help. I'm like, okay, you know, it was like I didn't know what to do. I was like, okay, where are you? And he's like, give me the cross streets in Manhattan. And I'm living in Jersey at the time. And I'm like, okay, I'll be there. You know, and hang up. And I'm just like, what do? You know? So, of course, I call, you know, my sponsor, my grand sponsor, and they're like, go get another member from the home group and go pick him up. And I'm like, all right, I'm on it, you know? Because now I feel like, kind of felt like when I was a little kid, you know? Like, I was all excited. Like, this was like a big, you know, they talked about the firing lines, you know, and that appealed to that juvenile side of me. Like, you know, that sounds awesome. I want to be on the firing lines. And I went and picked him up, and he didn't have a place to go, so I couldn't take him home, and I didn't want to leave him back on the streets. And so he slept in my car, and I slept in a tent for a couple of days. And I didn't, you know, with my keys to my car and my underwear, you know, and stuff kind of like that. My God wasn't that big yet, you know. I was just trying to remember thinking, like, please don't murder him, please don't kill him. You know, but I woke up. I'm like, how you doing? Let's get some coffee. I did Alcoholics Anonymous with him a lot, and I learned a lot about helping people in those early days when I had nothing to lose. Everything I had, half of whatever I had was his. You know, and that was the best I've ever sponsored anybody, I think. You know, I try to live up to that today, but there's nothing like that first guy, you know. And, you know, eventually my sponsor let us move in to his apartment. I mean, my parents had a house. I could have had a very nice setup, but instead I was sleeping on a couch because my sponsor said, if he's staying here, you're staying here, because I don't want to wake up with my TV missing. And I was like, okay. I'm like, so you want me to, so, you know, and I'm new, so I'm terrified of everything, you know, so I'm just like sitting on the couch watching him sleep, you know what I mean? Okay, he's asleep, you know, and it's like, oh, I don't know, and I spent the next 2.5 years just doing everything I could, and I have been sober for 4.5 years, but I spent the next 2.5 years actively trying to help other members of Alcoholics Anonymous as much as I could, and taking guys through the steps and just not caring about, you know, getting distracted here and there, but really being more focused on what I was given rather than what I was getting. And I tell you, I went, you know, the steps and strong sponsorship moved me from being a taker into being a giver, and then my self-will and Alcoholics Anonymous moved me right back from being a giver to being a taker again. I got into law school again as a result of me being, you know, living by these principles, and I got an internship working for the prosecutor's office. I had my own little badge and one of those little fancy pins, which meant a lot to me. It's all about image, and I don't know. It became really important to me. It became really, really important to me. I didn't stop doing Alcoholics Anonymous. On the outside, my feet were still moving in the rooms of AA. I was still going to speaking at meetings. I was still doing all these things. But on the inside, I was secretly thinking, like, finally I'm getting for me. You know, finally I got this career thing going. Finally I'm going to be a lawyer. All about me, 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 me. And little by little, I started to die on the inside. You know, I really started to die, and I didn't even know it, because as this thing, alcoholism, kills me, like I said, it distorted my perception. And so all those times, as I'm slowly dying, I'm looking around, and it's all your fault, and you're the problem, you know, and why are they doing this to me, and what the hell's wrong with them, you know. And, you know, I got to a point, I don't want to end on this, this is kind of, well, I got to a point where I, you know, pulled my car into the garage and hooked up the exhaust to the cabin. And I'd become an EMT in early recovery, and so I sort of knew the onset of carbon monoxide poisoning was that I would start to faint. And when I started to pass out, I got scared, and I knew I was going to die, and so I opened the car door and came out. And, all I can say is that nothing but my actions got me there that day, you know. My selfishness, my self-centeredness, you know, stop and doing the things that worked in Alcoholics Anonymous. Stop looking for the new guy, you know. Stop following directions, stop working the steps. You know, I just, I became, really what happened was I became convinced that my thinking was right. And I hope nobody suffers like that. Because that is my biggest, I'll tell you, the worst times I've ever had in my recovery have been when I am sure, I am 100% sure that I am right. And you are all wrong. And that is a very lonely place. And, you know, luckily, because of strong sponsorship and a really, you know, a home group that's been like a family to me, I'm still sober today. You know, I wouldn't have made it through those times without him because, you know, I failed out of law school. I a lot of the guys that I was sponsoring left me and went elsewhere. You know, some of them left and got drunk. I don't even know what, you know, it was like a fire sale. And if it wasn't for the, you know, strong sponsorship and a really loving home group, I wouldn't be here tonight. You know, and now it's going back to just the basics again. You know, talking to my sponsor, and when he gives me a direction, I say, okay, trying not to fight him. You know, just like I did when I was new. You know, just trying to lose that one thing that kills people like me, my judgment about what's right and wrong. You know, and, you know, like I said, I really appreciate the opportunity to come out here and speak. Thank you. Thanks.